love the idea of my inmost calm being unshakable. Would that it were so some days. Well, I'm looking at the clock, and I'm going to just call it now. We're not going to sing the closing hymn because this other stuff I got to do is much more important. Even though I love Life is the Greatest Gift of All, and Melora does love that hymn so much. But we're going to skip that one because we've got a lot of other things to show you and to talk about today. I think that beauty has gotten a bad rap. I guess what I actually mean is that beauty has gotten an overly simplified and flattened reputation that demeans it. We have arrived at a point now in which beauty is synonymous with pretty. Sometimes we hear the word beauty and think about whether something is fancy or attractive or glamorous. But that's not really beauty, though, at least not to me. That is surface assessment. That is a judgment about whether or not something appeals to you. That's not beauty. Beauty is much deeper and richer than that. Beauty stirs the soul, sparks and quickens the heart, and reminds us about the profound dimensions of being alive. Life is full of beauty, and it can be discovered and uncovered, noticed within and experienced among and beyond. I find it easiest to remember and pay attention to beauty and see it most directly myself in art and in nature. I can also see it in the faces and particularly the eyes of people around me, but sometimes less easily so. This morning, I want to invite you to look at beauty with me, to look at images, to listen to music, to remember in meditation and reflection where you have encountered beauty and what practices and ways of being help you hold on to it and savor it. One of the best teachers I ever had in my lifetime, one of my high school teachers, told me that given my passion for art, I must in my lifetime visit the Prado. One of the reasons for that statement is this painting, Diego Velázquez's masterpiece of 1656, Las Meninas, which sort of translates to maids in waiting. There is much that has been said and written about this one painting, and you kind of only are seeing part of it. Our laser pointer's not working, otherwise I would tell you this, but cut off a little bit at this far edge, you can see the easel and the paintbrush. That's Velázquez himself. So if you go home and look up this painting, he's kind of looking at you with his head a little bit sideways, looking around this huge easel that's in front of him. On the back wall, the two faces that are looking toward you are probably the king and queen of Spain. And there's lots of speculation about whether that was like a mirror of what he was painting, or you can read lots about it. And this is all part of the royal family that's here. And this painting has become kind of, I don't know, one of the most famous portraits ever painted. It is considered one of the most important paintings in Western art history. And it began sort of a fascination of mine with portrait painting. What is it about the way that we portray ourselves, the way artists can make us look at ourselves, and how we situate ourselves in relationship to our world and those that we are closest to that can communicate so much? This portrait and so many others by Velázquez, there's just a huge amount of I've been to the Prado because my teacher told me I had to go before I died. So many amazing Velázquez portraits. And as I walked through the galleries, I was in Madrid by myself. I was walking through the galleries. I was like, why does it keep talking about El Bosco? And it took me about half the day to realize that El Bosco is their translation of Hieronymus Bosch. So all of the famous Hieronymus Bosch paintings, Garden of Earthly Delights and things, is also at the Prado. But portraits, it seems to me, can serve to remind us that beauty is not always beautiful and can sometimes be discovered in unlikely faces and places. Portraits can be arresting and captivating and offer us soulfulness instead of surfaces. These faces look at you and you see not just whether or not they are pretty, you see expressions, you see feeling. This is the first and the earliest that I will share with you, and perhaps you have a favorite portrait artist, Rembrandt or Vermeer or Renoir. There have been so many who focused so much of their work on painting expression and demeanor and spirit. I invite you to take in each portrait I am about to show you, the faces of each person and the setting. The next slide is a painting to which I have deep sentimental attachment. There it is. In part because I have spent so much time in the company of this painting, and because my father has deep admiration for it. This painting is by John Singer Sargent, and it is entitled The Daughters of Edward Darley Boyd. If you go to see this painting in Boston, you will see that it is displayed with those two large Japanese vases in the room in front of the painting. This was painted by Sargent in 1882, hundreds of years after Velázquez, but he was deeply influenced by Velázquez's sense of light and shadow, as you can see, and the shape of the portrait is quite similar. I remember that my dad used to tell me that the painting had brought out lots and lots of commentary. Initially, people thought of it as sort of a standard, innocuous, typical painting of a wealthy man's daughters. The usual commissioned portrait of the time. Over time, however, people began to see psychological dimensions in this work. Was there something about the space, the shadows, and the large vases that felt foreboding? Was the positioning of the daughters a commentary on the distance or closeness they felt toward each other? Some now speculate that in a way this portrait is about childhood. The youngest girl in the foreground was 4 at the time, and the oldest girls in the back, partially obscured, were adolescents. And perhaps Singer Sargent was trying to tell us that they were being more independent, trying to get more space. One girl, you can't even see her face, which is very atypical for that time as she faces her sister. However you interpret the painting, it is beautiful and captivating. It feels as if we have entered the room with these 4 girls, and they were in the midst of their day, and they all look over toward us except the one sister. At the death of their father, these 4 sisters gifted this painting to the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, and that's where it hangs. None of them ever married, and the 2 in the back by the shadows apparently both struggled with mental health issues throughout their lives. An interesting kind of coda to the story of this painting. A more modern portrait artist is our next set of images. If you've been in my office, you've seen me being stared at by 2 girls painted by this woman. My mother introduced me to the work of Alice Neal. She was called by one curator one of the greatest portrait artists of the 20th century. Alice Neal lived from 1900 to 1984, and when I saw a retrospective of her work in 2001, I was blown away. She was a strong feminist and endured many significant losses in her life, including the loss of a daughter to diphtheria at the age of one. Most of her portraits are of people that were her neighbors and other artists and poets, people she connected with in New York City. I find her images project an almost palpable sense of the person. This one is Michael. Or at least of their state of mind in the moment that she painted them. These are not wealthy or famous people. She does have one portrait of Andy Warhol. But these, mostly, her portraits are of regular folks whose beauty, I think, shines through profoundly. I'm not sure when or even precisely why, but a bit over a decade ago, I was drawn toward architecture. Perhaps it began with early studies of the forms in art history class, but it then grew into a later appreciation of particularly modern architecture. My interest is in part embedded in how much I am moved by different forms of space. Architects can create spaces and places that inspire and intrigue, that welcome and hold us. As an architecture nerd, I now pay avid attention every year to who wins the Pritzker Prize. The Pritzker Prize is an award that is sometimes called the Nobel of Architecture. And over the years, it has introduced me to the work of many that I find immeasurably beautiful. I think I told you before about Zaha Hadid, who died several years ago, was a winner of the Pritzker Prize as well. The winner this year was 87-year-old Japanese architect Arata Isozaki. This picture is of the Palau Sant Jordi in Barcelona, a sports facility that he designed for the 1992 Summer Olympic Games. It is a 17,000-seat arena, but part of what interests me is not just the domed roof, but the fact that he tried to inform the shape by the Catalan structures of the Catalan-style vaults of that region of Spain. He finished it with locally sourced materials, including brick and tile and travertine, all from the area. About his work, the Pritzker jury said, Isozaki is a pioneer in understanding that the need for architecture is both global and local, and that those two forces are part of a single challenge. This building is one that he created in Qatar. It's the Qatar National Convention Center. And as you can see, pieces of the building look like a tree. Those pieces that look like a tree, he took inspiration from what is called the Sidrat al-Muntaha, a holy Islamic tree, which he used in the design of the building. I find his work quite interesting and compelling. Lastly, we will turn to a piece of music. Anyone who has spent any time talking with me recently knows that I am now a huge advocate of the NPR series Tiny Desk Concerts. If you Google Tiny Desk, up will pop images of about a decade's worth of intimate video performances recorded at the desk of All Songs Considered host Bob Boylan. These remarkable mini-concerts are often a three-song taste of a group playing a live, primarily acoustic version of their music. Every genre is covered, bluegrass to rap to everything, and I have already been introduced to numerous musicians I had never heard of who have become new favorites of mine. One such group is Lake Street Dive. I always want to say Lake Street Drive or Lake Shore Drive, but it's Lake Street Dive. And an offshoot of the Tiny Desk is what they call Night Owl, another NPR mini video concert shot in an interesting location. The song that you're about to hear by Lake Street Dive features the group performing their song, Must Have Been Something, in Brooklyn at a place that's called Retro Fret Vintage Guitars. So there's guitars all around them. I have found that at the end of a day, when I am exhausted and in need of inspiration, or in need of being transported to another level or another place, I can put on a tiny desk or a song like this, preferably in my headphones. I can close my eyes and just listen. And so I want to invite you now to do the same. If you feel comfortable closing your eyes, I invite you to do that. And just listen to this song for the 5 minutes it's on. Listen to the voice, to the instruments, to the lyrics. Allow it to sit and to simmer. What stands out? What connects? What doesn't? Where are the places of beauty in the 5 minutes that you spend with this song?
Shoot.
Beauty is always available to us in art, architecture, music, and the natural world, in our own beings and in those around us. What practices can help you see the beauty and remember its presence? Listening, like we just did. Gazing at art. The pauses in times outside in which you appreciate all of the small things that can mean so much. The delicacy of a flower's petals. The interaction of two different shades of green. The constancy of the ocean's waves. Whatever sources and forms of beauty most inspire, soothe, and move you, I hope you will make time daily to connect with it. We know our lives are enriched and enlivened and more joyful when we don't forget to seek and to savor beauty. May the encounters be many and the connections deep. Blessed be, and amen. So we'll move right into extinguishing the chalice and Aaron's musical benediction.